I'd like now to welcome Carissa Sanbonmatsu. She is principal investigator in the Division of Theoretical Biology and Biophysics at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And tonight she will be speaking at 7 o'clock at the Duane Smith Auditorium at Los Alamos High School in Los Alamos, and then again on Thursday at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe, both at 7 o'clock. It's all part of the Frontiers in Science lecture series. The lecture is titled Nature, Nurture, or Neither, the New Science of Epigenetics. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So, first of all, what is epigenetics as opposed to genetics?
Okay, so epigenetics, the word epi means over, and so epigenetics is sort of something over genetics. And what's been found is that there's sort of this complex layer of genetic programming that can occur while the embryo is in the womb, shortly after birth, and throughout your whole life. And this is something that's quite different from the previous thinking in molecular biology, where your genes were sort of a fixed, hardwired thing, and then maybe you might have one fluke mutation once in a while. But it turns out that there's this very intricate framework allowing the cell to program the DNA in response to different environmental factors throughout your life.
So one thing that doesn't change when you're talking about epigenetics is the actual sequence of genes.
That's right. That's right. But what does change is which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off.
So maybe you could give us a little mini course in genetics right now.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are things like, I mean, I'm going back to high school biology here, but there are genetic traits like eye color, and those are pretty much fixed. And then there are things that are not really so fixed. Give us some examples of that.
Okay. So, yeah, so there are things that are not so fixed, such as susceptibility to disease would be a major one. And one thing I'm going to touch on in my talk is that your response to stress and how your stress levels are regulated throughout your life. And it turns out that this is something that is highly affected by your early years during development, and but can get sort of permanently changed due to how you spent your first 2 years or so.
And I guess the question is that how you relate to stress in the first place is that genetic?
I think most people nowadays think it's epigenetic. And so the idea is that, for example, there are these classic studies on mice done in 2004 where they monitored how the mother nurtures the mouse in its first week or two after birth. And they found that if it was nurtured a lot, it would have a healthy stress response through its whole life. But if it was not nurtured in that first week, its stressed equilibrium would be thrown out of whack for its whole life. And this is due to the stress chemistry that happens in the first 2 weeks. And this stress chemistry reprograms the DNA, and that persists throughout the life. And they're finding these studies to be confirmed in humans just in the past few years.
One of the things, I was doing a Google search on the popular literature because, I mean, we can't get into the deep molecular science of this
sure.
stuff without inviting everybody to a graduate course. But one of the things that I was reading was that women who were pregnant and went through 9/11 in New York City, their children had stronger stress reactions.
Yeah. And so without getting into too many details, basically, the chemistry inside the womb is doing a massive amount of programming on the DNA of the developing embryo. And so depending on what's going on in the womb, that could really change around a lot of the programming. So it could very well readjust the stress sort of thermostat.
So there's a lot of environmental factors that have these epigenetic effects. And so somebody might have a kind of more difficult response to stress, or they might have more susceptibility to disease. Is that correct?
That's right. Uh-huh.
Are there any epigenetic effects that are positive?
Most of the effects studied to date are many are related to the development of the embryo and then disease. And so I would say these studies are positive in the sense that, you know, if we understand how the epigenetics can create the disease, we may be able to understand how to reverse it. One big difference between epigenetics and genetics is that many of the epigenetic changes are actually reversible. So there have been some studies looking at therapeutics with drugs that can reverse these changes in the stress equilibrium. Now, in addition, there have been some other studies on diet and exercise showing that your diet can tremendously affect your DNA programming. And so if you have a good diet, you won't get certain diseases like diabetes. But if your diet is not so good, you're at high risk for diabetes. And there was one really recent study on the storage of fat showing that exercise can change the programming on how fat is stored.
We're talking to Carissa Sanbonmatsu about epigenetics. Can the epigenetic changes caused by the environment, whatever they are, susceptibility to disease or stress, can those then be passed on to the next generation and the next and so on?
Oh, yeah. One of the fascinating things about epigenetics is that many of these changes can be passed on to future generations. So even though the DNA is not fully mutated, the epigenetic change remains sort of programmed into the DNA, so the gene would remain switched on or switched off, and those can be passed down to future generations, sometimes as many as 10 generations in certain studies.
What are the animals that have been used to do these studies? Is it primarily mice?
Primarily mice and rodents, although in the past few years there have been numerous studies in humans coming out. And so, for example, for development, they may look at placental tissue or umbilical cord tissue. And they're also getting people volunteering blood samples now. There was one about the stress response that came out recently where they had 99 people volunteering samples, and they were able to confirm the studies done in rodents.
What studies, in other words, for example, the human genome, has been in place that has allowed people like you to do these studies of epigenetics? In other words, what's the foundation on which you're building?
I would say that one of the foundations is all the work on stem cells that was done in the early 2000s, I think. Stem cells are sort of intrinsically epigenetic in that the idea is to nowadays to take an adult cell and erase all the epigenetic programming so it's sort of a blank slate, and then you can try to change it into another cell like a liver cell or a heart cell. And so that's some of the foundations. Now, one of the things that sort of caused this explosion of epigenetics research is the new DNA sequencing technology. And in the past two, three years alone, the number of DNA sequences has sort of skyrocketed. And so it's brought the price of doing a single genome down to around $10,000. And the advantage with that is not only can we do one genome, but we can look at the genome during development as a function of time and also as a function of many different environmental factors. So you can get many, many genomes. And with the latest technology in the pipeline, this looks like it's going to skyrocket once again in the next 2 years or so.
It's interesting because that's another example of the way economics are related to research. In other words, if you have all the knowledge in the world, but it's prohibitively expensive, your research isn't going to happen.
That's right. That's right. And so with these low prices, it really expands the field and what you can do, because, you know, 10 years ago, it was like a huge monumental event just to get one genome, something like a few billion dollars to do that. But nowadays at $10,000, people can really look at what is the genome doing during different conditions and during different stages of development. And this really opens up a whole new window on how the programming works, I think.
If you have identical twins with the exact same genes and one of them gets a disease and one of them doesn't, is that automatically epigenetics involved?
It's certainly suspicious for epigenetics, I think, and so that's one of the telltale signs. So one of the examples for epigenetics, like you mentioned, is identical twins, and the idea is that here are two individuals who have identical genes but may have many different differences, such as personality traits and also susceptibility to disease and which diseases they get. For example, autism. Many people think autism is epigenetic now, and I think there have been some twin studies on that.
And with the twin studies, isn't it usually twins separated at birth? Or twins who grew up in quite different environments?
Yeah. They often look at twins separated at birth, right? Or who grew up in different environments. And so these are very interesting case studies for epigenetics. And so, for example, if twins are separated at birth, they may have very different environments they're faced with, especially in the early years, and this may change their epigenetic programming. Now, in addition, even if they are not separated at birth, they may have slightly different conditions in the womb, and this could also change their epigenetics.
So going back to this question of, I mean, epigenetic changes cause certain genes to be turned on or turned off at different times, and environmental factors such as food and stress and toxins and things would cause that to happen. More specifically, what are some examples of genes that get turned on and turned off because of these environmental factors?
Okay, so one example is this cortisol receptor gene. And so cortisol is the hormone that's secreted when you're under stress. And it turns out that this gene is epigenetically programmed during early years of life. And so what happens is that for healthy, for example, in the case of rats, the healthy rats who are nurtured a lot, in addition to the cortisol stress hormone, they also secrete the sort of feel-good hormone serotonin. And it turns out that serotonin turns on this receptor for cortisol. And once the receptor is turned on, then everything is happy. The receptor can sort of catch the cortisol and regulate the hormones. Now, in the case of rats who were not nurtured in their early years, here they have abnormally high cortisol levels in their early years when all the epigenetic programming is happening. And in that case, the cortisol receptor gene is turned off epigenetically. And then it really throws this thermostat out of whack, and then it stays like that for the rest of their life.
Knowing this, what can actually be done? Because Lord knows everybody's trying to de-stress themselves. Everybody's going to meditation classes and taking drugs and taking herbal teas and everything else in the world. Do these things have reverse epigenetic effects?
Yeah, there are. Well, I know there's one therapeutic that targets one of the epigenetic programmers. They're sort of, we've been talking about the DNA getting programmed, but what does the programming? There are these little proteins in the cell that turn on and off the epigenetic switches. And these epigenetic programmers really play a key role. And right now there are a few drugs on the market that sort of freeze the epigenetic programmer. And one of these turns out to help with stress.
Are there other examples of those kinds of therapeutic drugs that work on an epigenetic level?
Yeah. There are, I think, three or four out now for cancer. At this stage, they're only treating liquid cancer, not solid tumor cancers, but they're treating, for example, different kinds of leukemia. And again, in these drugs, it's similar to the stress drug where the drug targets this epigenetic program and sort of freezes the programming. Although it's sort of broad in that it's freezing all the programmers, it's better than killing the entire cell, which is what typical chemotherapy or radiation therapies do.
Are these things mainstream yet?
They do have FDA approval, and they've been on the market for several years now.
Very interesting. We're talking to Carissa Sanbonmatsu about epigenetics. Let's talk for a moment about genetics, because one of the things that we talk about, for example, with ionizing radiation is that it actually changes your gene sequence. And when that happens, the body has a way of repairing itself up to a point. How does that work?
Okay, so a mutation induced by, for example, radiation, there are many DNA repair mechanisms in place to try to take care of those mutations. However, many cancers, it turns out that it's sort of a series of mutations that have to sort of build up before a cell goes cancerous. Now, in epigenetics, it turns out that there's another kind of epigenetic programming error, which is specific to these DNA repair kinds of things. And so these I call sort of DNA chaos genes, where there are certain sequences in the DNA that cause sort of radical transposition mutations where giant segments of the DNA are transferred to other chromosomes. And these DNA chaos regions are sort of silenced or turned off in normal healthy individuals. But some of the epigenetic errors that happen during cancer is that these DNA chaos genes get turned on, and so then some of the DNA repair mechanisms are not as efficient, and then this is worse for cancer.
What does all this mean, or what kind of implications does this research have for our understanding of evolution?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and that's sort of on the cutting edge of this research, and a lot of people are speculating on this. So the idea is that with the epigenetic programming, it's almost Lamarckian in a sense, in that the environment can sort of change how your genes act, you know, how they're programmed. And there are cases where as many as 10 generations are seen to take these epigenetic programs.
Now, backing up a second to high school biology, tell us what Lamarckian means.
Oh, sorry. Lamarckian is sort of where I think the classic example of Lamarckian is the giraffe, where the giraffe wants to get food in a high tree, and so therefore its neck grows to get that food.
Which we learned wasn't true, which was not the way things work.
That's what people used to think. And so sort of Lamarck is making a comeback nowadays with epigenetics. And so I think it's a little analogous to maybe Isaac Newton and Einstein, where Isaac Newton really did the bulk of all classical physics. And then Einstein expanded on that and showed that Newton wasn't entirely right on everything. But still, he was, got the majority of things right. And I think it's similar with epigenetics and Lamarck, where there are sort of exceptions to the rule that are being found now, where some people think that, you know, the epigenetics can change how your DNA is programmed. But it's still a little controversial in that it's not clear that these are evolutionary changes. So they've been shown they could persist for maybe 5 to 10 generations, but in evolutionary terms, you want them to persist for thousands and thousands of generations.
Well, right, and that's where the DNA sequence comes in. If that changes,
right.
Then you've got giraffes with longer necks or creatures that come out of the water and grow fur and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so what one idea is that, you know, maybe epigenetics could be some kind of exploratory mechanism in evolution where it's probing different niches or different functions, and if it's found that that's really good, you know, maybe someday a real mutation could happen that would fill that same epigenetic niche.
So tell us more about the research that you were doing at Los Alamos National Laboratory.
So in Los Alamos, what we're working on is sort of how the epigenetic programmers find the right places on the DNA, which is a really key part of epigenetics. So we've been talking about the DNA getting programmed and the programmers doing the programming, but it's really an unsolved issue in epigenetics on how those programmers find the exact precise location. And this is important because not only do they have to find the right location, but the timing's got to be just perfect, for example, during embryo development. So they've got to be in the right place at the right time. And that's a tough problem to solve. And so what many people think nowadays is that there's a molecular cousin to DNA called RNA. And RNA is continually being emanated from the DNA, you know, throughout the lifetime of the cell. And so what we think is happening is that the RNA is folding up into compact structures and recruiting these programmers to the right place on the DNA. And so we're doing the first studies of what these gigantic RNA molecules look like, and we're trying to understand how they work and how they could bring the programmers to the DNA.
What is your hope for this research?
Our hope is, number one, to understand the basic mechanism of epigenetics. But then the next step is to lay the foundation for pharmaceutical studies. And so the idea is that, like right now, the epigenetic drugs are kind of broad in that they just shut off the programmers. But because these RNA molecules they're highly, highly specific, not only to the tissue type, but also they can be specific to the time during development. So if you could create drugs that target these RNAs, you could really have highly specific drugs that could target very specific cancers or even specific individuals someday.
We're talking to Carissa Sanbonmatsu about epigenetics. Now, one thing that we're talking about is the heritability of these essentially acquired traits. Now, I can see how that happens in sperm cells, which are continually being produced, but I thought that, for example, women were already born with all their eggs Can those existing eggs be changed?
Yeah. The existing eggs could be changed. And importantly, you know, once the egg is fertilized, it goes through, you know, a lot of changes to get from the egg to the embryo to the baby. And that whole process is just filled with epigenetic decisions that need to be made, depending on maybe where the egg is in the womb, what the exact hormonal and chemical conditions are in the womb at whichever day you're on. And so, you know, things like smoking, the mom's diet are shown to have very significant effects.
Now, things like smoking, we've known for quite a while that that's really bad for you.
Right.
What do we know for sure at this point in epigenetic terms about what kind of diet is good for you and what else is good for you?
Okay, I'm not really the authority on these nutritional issues, but I can just talk about one study back to mice maybe. And so that has to do with folic acid. And there are these, there's a famous pair of mice called the agouti mice, named after the agouti gene. And so it turns out that you can have identical twin mice, but depending on if this gene is switched on or off by epigenetics, one will be almost twice as big as the other and have a strong propensity towards diabetes. And that all, and that epigenetic switch is activated by folic acid. So it turned out if the mother mouse was fed folic acid, then the sort of normal-sized mouse would result. And then without the folic acid, you'd get this diabetes mouse.
Can we safely assume that in whatever conditions a creature evolved, those are kind of the optimal conditions for a positive epigenetic result? In other words, if folic acid is good for a mouse and prevents it from getting diabetes, out in nature, when mice evolved, they were getting enough folic acid in their diet.
Yeah. There's always going to be the oddball or the outlier, maybe, where they, in general, they probably had enough folic acid, but maybe there was an outlier who didn't have enough, and you would see this change.
Right. But in other words, when things go smoothly,
right.
I mean, it's the anomalies that you're, that we're looking at,
yeah,
that are interesting,
right,
for human
that's
disease,
right,
control.
Exactly, right.
And those anomalies are based on the fact that we live in societies that don't provide the conditions in which we evolved on some level.
It's possible.
What about environmental toxins like bus exhaust, pesticides, Lord knows what is on our food and in our air?
Yeah, there are some studies that have been done on pesticides, for example, that are have been shown to have these epigenetic effects. And I think there are many more studies like these in the pipeline now that are being planned. So this is a really active area of research. And the idea is that the chemical, especially during the pregnancy, if the chemical is ingested, this could reprogram the DNA and have some kind of unanticipated effect.
And so, knowing that, there is even more than there already is impetus to limit the use of these chemicals in a way that they don't get into our diet.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on this, and it may be too soon to say, but it would not surprise me if you know, a lot of these things were affecting how your DNA is programmed.
So you have a PhD in astrophysics?
Yes, that's right, astrophysics.
So how did you get from galaxy scale to cellular scale?
It's been a long journey, and actually I was fascinated with the origin of things in general, and so I took a fascination to the origin of life, and so I did a stint on that and ended up working on a lot of RNA molecules that were important for the origin of life. And then since I had expertise in RNA, it was easy to make the switch to epigenetics, where RNA is really the field of RNA is sort of exploding in epigenetics right now.
So you are giving these lectures. We've actually missed a couple of them, but there's one tonight at the Duane Smith Auditorium at 7 o'clock. That's at Los Alamos High School. And then on Thursday at the James A. Little Theater, you're speaking again at 7 o'clock here in Santa Fe. So will you be showing visuals that help people to understand this?
Sure. There'll be a lot of visuals and different kinds of metaphor. One of the main metaphors I'll be talking about is your iPhone, and a lot of different tools to try to get these ideas clearly across to the audience.
What do you mean by your iPhone?
So the iPhone metaphor is sort of that your iPhone, your DNA is sort of like the iPhone itself, and that it's like the hardware or the processor, and it's sort of fixed for that generation of iPhones, where the epigenetic program is like the software, and this it's much easier to change the software than the hardware, and then the app would be one epigenetic program. So for example, if you're trying to get directions from A to B and use Google Maps, Google Maps would be like the epigenetic program. And then the outcome or the instructions to get from A to B, this would be like the cell fate. For example, what kind of cell it's going to be, like your heart cell or your brain cell, a cancerous cell or a non-cancerous cell. And so this is the iPhone metaphor.
Very interesting. So it does, to some extent, help us to understand how it is that some people can have a family tendency toward a certain illness and not manifest it, and somebody else can have nobody in their entire family develop an illness, but they get it.
Exactly. So there are some of these sort of late onset illnesses, for example, where the something that happened in the environment or during when you're in the womb that may have triggered one of these epigenetic programs to cause the disease.
Carissa Sanbonmatsu is the principal investigator in the Division of Theoretical Biology and Biophysics at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay, thank you too, and I hope to see you out there.